Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, frontline mission in the Philippines. An oblate missionary recounts his own dramatic story of promoting dialogue and a culture of peace between Christians and Muslims. Plus, how Catholics in England and Wales are putting into practice the principles of interfaith dialogue. And a new era of relations between the Catholic and Orthodox churches in Cyprus, following Pope Benedict's visit to the island last June. The remote islands of the southern Philippines rarely make it into the news headlines. Since the early 1970s, the region of Mindanao has been plagued by conflict, with government troops fighting separatist Muslim rebels seeking independence on their ancestral lands. At regular intervals, the conflict flares, earning brief news items of killings, kidnappings, or military manoeuvres, while the long-running peace negotiations seem unable to deliver a lasting solution. Church leaders in the overwhelmingly Catholic country appeal regularly for an end to the violence. The Cardinal Archbishop of Manila recently urged the government to pull military forces out of Mindanao, where their presence only serves to perpetuate the spiral of violence. Some priests and religious working in the region have even paid with their lives for their peace and reconciliation work.
I was the parish priest of Mount Carmel Cathedral in 1997 when the late Bishop Benjamin de Jesus was murdered. And I cried and cried and cried. That's one reason why I left Jolo, because I hated all Muslims.
Father Roberto Lysan is an oblate priest who has served for the past two decades in the majority Muslim communities of the southern Philippines, seeking to promote dialogue as an essential part of the reconciliation process.
In Asia, we were able to come up with four kinds of dialogue. First is dialogue of life, you know, the day-to-day life, wherever you go in the marketplace or at the mall or the street or the terminal, you meet people of different religions. And we are all children of God and we have to deal with them in a nice way, like brother or sister, you know. And that's one. And another dialogue is the dialogue of action. When there are problems around, and instead of doing it alone, you can work together and address that problem, which is affecting the same community inhabited by Muslims and Christians. So that is also one way of expressing dialogue. Another is a dialogue of discourse, so words, that's what you said. You know, you talk about your different religions, what is Islam, what is Christianity, and you try to understand each other, and oh, it's beautiful religion, you know. And then the dialogue of spirituality. That's the dialogue where you express your own experience of God and why you pray, why you believe in God, and what is God telling you. So it's very enriching because you learn from each other different ways of dealing with each other and also enriching your own faith.
It's not always easy, though, in Mindanao, is it, to engage in any of these kinds of dialogue? It's been known as an area of conflict.
It's not so easy. I'm living in a Muslim community which has a minority Christian, and we have experienced four wars already. And during these four wars, many of the local inhabitants evacuated from their original villages. And this is where I find myself in. And you are right, it's very difficult really to engage in dialogue. First, there are some internal problems as well. You know, within the Catholic Church, when you start relating with Muslims and some of your Christians misunderstood you, even your fellow priests sometimes misunderstand your own work, you know, because you are dealing with Muslims. Why don't you give all your time to fellow Christians? You are a parish priest at the same time.
But Father Roberto's mission goes well beyond the confines of normal parish work and onto the front lines of the conflict that has devastated the region for decades.
So I deal with rebels and I also deal with soldiers. The rebels happen to be Muslims and the military happens to be Christians. So I try to mediate and to stand in between. But again, sometimes it is misinterpreted by many sectors, including local politicians who are Christians. So when you deal with rebels, they think you are pro-rebels. when you deal with Muslims, they think you are pro-Muslims. But you know, in my own experience, the military has begun to understand my work. As long as you are, you know, very clear with your position that you don't side with anybody, because you just want to create a peaceful world. These are all children of God, and soldiers and rebels are also victims of circumstances as well.
It sounds like a very challenging, a very dangerous job that you're doing. Have you had threats to your life?
Of course, very dangerous. Sometimes I get some fears, you know. But I just have to do it. I'm just following my own mission. The danger is always there. In fact, three of my confreres were murdered. One bishop was murdered in 1997 in Holo, where we lived together for 9 years. Another 3 years later, another priest was murdered. And then just 2 years ago, another priest was murdered. So it's really very dangerous. But again, it depends on how you deal and how you relate with them. It's the respect. You know, that's why even among rebels, I have the respect of the rebels, because I don't deal with them as if I'm better than them and they are the evil in this world. I know they are just victims of circumstances. That's why I always say, in war, the real enemy is not the rebel or is not the soldier. In war, the real enemy is war itself. And you know what? We were able to establish peace zones, villages destroyed by war. And these are villages inhabited by Muslims and Christians. So I had to negotiate with the rebels and also with the military not to make these villages as battleground of their forces anymore. Please, have more compassion for these people. They are very poor. And I was able to get their commitment. And that's why these villages were expanding. And because there is a ceasefire right now, so during the launching, they were there sitting on the same table, the military and the rebels.
So you're saying there is a little bit of progress just in recent months. There is at least some sense of trust being established.
Yes, yes and no. The negotiation at the top level is really trying to make their way through, restoring again the trust between its group, between its party. But you know, peace is not just about talking there at the top. It is not a guarantee, because there is a war going on in the hearts of the people at the grassroots. That's why we complemented the effort of the government and the rebels in their negotiation at the top level by doing our own peace initiatives at the grassroots. That is, establishing peace zones at the grassroots level with their own support. Because in these peace zones, we also conduct cultural peace seminars to the local inhabitants to restore this strained relationship created by the war. Because if you are even a civilian, if you are a Muslim civilian, you side always with the rebels. And if you are a Christian civilian, you side with the military. So the war is not just happening in the battlefields between two forces, but also in the hearts of people of Mindanao. So that's why we are doing this. And we are trying to support each other. That's why we also go on advocacy and lobbying at the top level with the military generals and also with the Central Committee of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front and also at the grassroots. So right now we have a very close coordination. And you see, this is really a work of dialogue, because if there is none of that, I think this is not possible.
Where do you begin, as you say, to change the hearts and minds of people who've only ever known war?
You know, I always believed in the basic goodness of every person. I'm getting emotional because I begin to think and see the images of these people who suffered so much in evacuation centers. These are the same kind of people that I see in evacuation centers during the four wars. Children, these young, you know, kids and mothers, you know. By dealing with them, that's always what is in their heart. We don't want to war, we don't want to war anymore. Even the soldiers, they don't want to war anymore. They know how cruel and how ugly war is. But sometimes because of the political problem, that's why they are led into that. So we have to understand that. And that belief made me to go into remote areas and deal with rebels and also with the military. But you have to be very constant with your principle. And you know that you also care for them.
You talked about children particularly. I imagine many of them are caught up as child soldiers, aren't they, in the fighting?
Yeah, I saw some of them. I saw some of them carrying firearms, young as, you know, maybe 15 years old. When there is that perception of injustice perpetrated by the national government on their own people. So even young guys, they join the military movement to defend the remaining territory, because it's a long problem in Mindanao, it's about land. But we are very much involved in advocacy, especially letting the people know the root cause of the problem. Because many people don't know about the root cause of the problem. They just think because you're a Muslim, you're bad, and why you're, you know, why you're in rebellion. That's why I always tell people, you know, the first and urgent issue right now is not really solving the problem. It's understanding the problem first. Because if you haven't already have the solution to the problem and people don't accept it, then it goes to nothing. And that's what happened. 2 years ago, the government and the rebel movement have come up to a sort of a framework of the solution to the centuries-old problem in Mindanao. I was supposed to be there during the signing in Malaysia. I was invited by the government, but then it did not proceed because there was a lot of reaction from local politicians, and they happened to be fellow Christians who don't know about the root cause of the problem in Mindanao. Where did it start? Why? How?
Can you put that in very simple terms for us? I know it's a long, complicated history of conflict.
It's very simple. Islam came to the Philippines much earlier than Christianity, almost 300 years. And then Christianity came, brought by the Spaniards, and converted the local inhabitants. So, in other words, Mindanao, which is the heart of the conflict now in the Philippines, used to be 75% majority of Mindanao because of migration, which started during the American period in the 1940s. Christians from other parts of the Philippines migrated to Mindanao, and suddenly Mindanao is now dominated by Christians. And many of the lands were given to the Christians. So it's a minority-majority dynamic. The Muslims now lost control of their own ancestral land. So that's the main problem, actually.
How optimistic are you, though? As you say, there were proposed solutions which came to nothing. You're conducting this very long, painstaking work of trying to change and to educate people. How optimistic are you that there is some hope for a solution?
I am optimistic in the sense that at least now in the government, I have the impression that they understand the problem now. And they are prepared to solve this problem, not using military solution, but a peaceful political settlement in the negotiating table. Same with the rebels. They are tired of war already. Some of their core members in the Central Committee are getting old. And they know that they cannot get what they wanted through the use of arms. So they are really pursuing the negotiation. All that we want to see is really the trust and confidence of the two panels to solve this problem right there, despite all the problems on the ground. Because, you know, there are also sectors that don't want the peace process, both from the side of the government and on the side of the rebels. But now what I can say is that at least those who are in the higher ups have the same commitment to solve the problem in Mindanao through a peaceful process and the negotiating table.
Father Roberto Lyson is convinced the patient grassroots work of his peace and reconciliation seminars is now paying off. Up to 1,000 Muslim, Christian and indigenous people have joined in ceasefire watches, which report violations and support the work of negotiating teams in Asia and the European Union. Yet despite his optimism, the traumas of watching children die in their mothers' arms throughout these war years have taken a deep toll on Father Roberto. What hurt him most of all was when his own church leaders failed to understand the nature of this mission and criticised him for siding with the Muslims rather than the Catholic community.
Religious leader could sometimes be very exclusive. Sometimes I call it a divider by nature. Islam or Catholic Church. And your primary responsibility is to defend the doctrines of the church and protect your own people. If there are non-Christians who are harassing your Christian community, you tend to sympathize with your own community, both, vice versa. And that's why very difficult to transcend that exclusiveness. As a religious, you are there not just to show your compassion for your own people as a Christian, but to show compassion to children of God. You are all children of God. You know what? I was the parish priest of Mount Carmel Cathedral in 1997 when the late Bishop Benjamin de Jesus was murdered. And I cried and cried and cried. That's one reason why I left Jolo, because I hated all Muslims. When I arrived in the town I was assigned, war broke out between the rebels, Muslim rebels, and the military. 30,000 civilians were displaced. So I found myself there in the midst of the suffering of people. You know what? When you hear the sounds of mothers crying, the sounds of mothers and children crying and weeping in the night, you don't anymore ask whether they are Muslims or Christians. That's when I was able to overcome my hatred towards Muslims, and I didn't understand why. I found myself right in their midst. Not only helping Muslims, but Christians as well, you know. They are all fellow human beings.
Do you still find this resistance to the work that you do?
I still find myself sometimes walking alone, you know. My most painful experience is not really risking my life there in the battlefields, you know, in the middle of the night, ferrying out civilians because the war was about to erupt. No, it was not risking my life there and saving lives. It's when people, sometimes your own, let you feel that what you are doing is wrong. But when you're on the ground and find yourself there in the midst of that situation, it's very difficult. But at least I get support now over the years, because what I did was also to explain to fellow oblates and fellow priests, diocesan priests as well. Because dialogue is not my mission. No, it's not. It's not just the mission of the oblates. According to Redemptoris Missio, it is an integral part of the evangelizing mission of the church. And therefore, it must be the local church that must be in the forefront of this mission. And Pope Benedict just said 2 years ago, you know what he said? Interreligious dialogue is not an option for us. It is a vital necessity of our time.
My thanks there to Father Roberto Lyson, an oblate missionary who has worked for the past 2 decades in the majority Muslim communities of the southern Philippines. Meeting God in Friend and Stranger is the name of a comprehensive document about interfaith relations issued by the Catholic Bishops of England and Wales in April 2010. It's a lengthy publication setting out the principles of Catholic teaching, plus some interesting practical examples of where interfaith activities are working best in parishes and dioceses around the country.
It's an excellent document, a very straightforward, easy-to-read document, which is still very complex, so it manages not to sacrifice any of the complex theological context and to still remain readable and accessible.
Katharina Muller is secretary for the Interreligious Relations Committee of the Bishops' Conference.
It's called Meeting God in Friend and Stranger, and it's available for download from our website. It's available from Christian bookshops, from the Catholic Truth Society, and I can very much recommend it. It's written very much with everybody in mind, very much with the option for everyone to study it and learn from the document. And it urges Catholics to enter into interreligious dialogue. And I think that's a very important point to make.
Do you think it has been received in a positive way by people? What reactions have you had so far?
I think it's been received in a very positive manner indeed, and not only by Catholics. I think it's very good for Catholics to have all teaching on interreligious dialogue in one place and to be able to use that in dialogue as well, to say, look, this is our official position. We're not doing this as a hobby, you know, or because we're the funny people who it is important to, but this is the official church line. This is important to all of us. Our bishops are urging us to do that. And also my ecumenical contact, and in fact contacts from other religions. Now obviously it's a document that is aimed at Catholics, so it's not a document that speaks to these contacts so much, but it's been very well received indeed, and I think it inspires us, other churches and other religions, to also make their own position clearer, to come up with similar documents, similar statements. And I think that's a very positive thing, actually.
You're right that in the past it was sometimes seen to be very in favour of interfaith dialogue, was sometimes seen as a rather sort of lefty, trendy thing to do, wasn't it? A rather liberal position,
yes,
by those who weren't able to defend perhaps the truths of their own faith.
Very much so, yes. And I think it's very important that the document makes a point that, no, this is not new teaching. This is just a new compilation of teaching that has always been around, and it's always been important to have that dialogue. But this is just a new, just to get it out there again, and to have it all in one place, which I think is very helpful. And I think really, if we take our belief seriously, that we are a church in constant dialogue with our God, and that we have a God who's entered into that very costly dialogue, then if you want to take our own belief seriously, we can not afford not to enter into dialogue with others as well.
As you know, many parish priests will say, yes, that's fine, we get on perfectly nicely with our Jewish and Muslim neighbours, but we're far too busy as it is without embarking on any new initiatives to support this work.
Well, and I'm very aware that people are incredibly busy, and that priests are busy, and lay people have very busy lives. But I think that dialogue is something that can be shared very easily. And when I'm talking about dialogue, I'm talking about the wider definition that the document also has. So it's not just sitting down together and discussing the finer theological points. You know, it's as easy as having a chat with a Muslim neighbour, or extending good wishes to a Jewish friend at a Jewish festival. Or, you know, indeed to share a meal, maybe a Christmas dinner with a family who is not Christian. And that sort of everyday contact can help make excellent progress with dialogue between the religions. So it's not something that should be left to experts. And indeed, the document says that lay people are often very well placed, actually, to enter into that dialogue. So it stresses that responsibility of lay people who are in the world, who have colleagues and friends and neighbours of different faiths, to actually enter into that dialogue.
Do you have any best practice stories, any areas where you really have seen extraordinary results from just this, as you say, very straightforward type of dialogue of daily life?
Well, I think there are a lot of touching stories out there, actually. Just very recently, one of my diocesan coordinators, there's an interreligious coordinator in every diocese, has got Muslim and Catholic women together, and they've shared their stories of praying with the rosary and with the Muslim prayer beads, and it was a very warm, very touching occasion. Also, I know of a Catholic and a Jewish lady, again a coordinator, who struck up a very fast friendship by interreligious dialogue. And I think it's these things that might look fairly small, but that really make a difference to communities and to how people feel about each other, really.
Are you suggesting that women may be leading the way in this field or not?
Well, I think women are still often the people who pick children up from the school gate and, you know, the family managers to an extent. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, and I think men are coming into that field as well, but I think at the moment we very much have women as the centre of family still, and you know, they're arranging the play dates for the children, and they're picking the children up from school, and they're probably the ones who remember the neighbours' birthdays, you know, and they probably remember the neighbours' festivals as well, you know. So, yeah, I think women are doing fairly well in that field, yeah.
Thanks there to Catharina Muller, Secretary for the Interreligious Relations Committee of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And finally, the Synod Fathers, who've been meeting here in the Vatican discussing the future of the Church in the Middle East, may have headed home now, but the work of drawing up a final document from the 2 weeks of intense discussions has only just begun. Among the key issues under the spotlight is the question of closer relations between the different Christian churches across the region. The ecumenical delegate from the Orthodox Church in Cyprus at the Synod, Archimandrite Kikotis Chrysostomos, said Pope Benedict's own visit to Cyprus back in June ushered in a new era of relations between the Holy See and his island nation. He told me he'd brought a message from his own archbishop to the Pope and to all the Synod Fathers.
This official message, first of all, his beatitude, the Archbishop of Cyprus, Chrysostomos, had thanked the Holy Father for his visit in the island of Cyprus, because that meant a lot for Cyprus and the people of Cyprus. And then, of course, in this message, his beatitude addressed to all the people, to the members of this synod, the message that how things are going in Cyprus, about the churches, about the communities, the parishes, in an ecclesiastical way, in a theological way. And of course, he said about the problem that Cyprus faces because of the Turkish army in Cyprus. And of course, he also addressed the point of the ecumenical love, which is among the Christians and the Christian families, not only in the Middle East, but around the world.
Dialogue hasn't always been easy in Cyprus. There are those, aren't there, who don't want to see a gradual warming of relations between the Orthodox and the Catholics there.
Yes, well, officially there is a dialogue between the Roman Catholic Church, as we say, the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. There is the official dialogue between the Holy See and the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople. And in this frame, we had this dialogue also in Cyprus in October. So, of course, there are always voices which are against some fundamentalism, but I think in everywhere you can find such voices. Of course, the Church of Cyprus takes this fully into consideration and does the most to facilitate the dialogue and to find always the ideal way to have a result during these dialogues. It's a dialogue which is always in continuation, so we expect to see the results in the future.
You mentioned Pope Benedict's visit to the island. What impact do you think that had? What long-term impact, perhaps, can it have on the ecumenical relations between the two churches?
Well, not only in the ecumenical relations. That was something amazing, very, very great. In 2,000 years of Christianity, the Holy Father, this one, Benedict the 16th, is the first father who showed such a great interest for Cyprus, and his visit meant a lot in every aspect and in every way. It is a real blessing for the island and the people of Middle East, of course, for the dialogue. Actually, this is the reason why we are here today, participating in the Synod of the Bishops of the Middle Eastern Churches. So when the Holy Father came in Cyprus, he was warmly welcomed by not only by his beatitude, the archbishop, but also by all the members of the Church of Cyprus. And this has a great meaning in order to show our will and our effort towards the unity to come in the Christian body. So there are things to come, so I cannot evaluate now. It's of a great importance and of a great interest. I'm expecting new things to emerge out of this great visit of the Holy Father in Cyprus.
Thanks there to Archimandrite Kikotis Chrysostomos, the ecumenical delegate from the Orthodox Church in Cyprus at the recent Synod on the Middle East. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.